All right, I'd like you to take your Bibles this morning and turn to Romans chapter 8. When we do it God's way, He wants us to be the head and not the tail. In the next two messages, we're going to talk more about how and the kingdom will be ours once again.
Welcome to Mission to Israel, a broadcast ministry featuring author, teacher, and evangelist Ted R. Weiland. The focus of this ministry is to open the eyes of our people and give insight into the issues we find ourselves facing in this day and age. Our address is Mission to Israel, Post Office Box 248, Scotts Bluff, Nebraska 69363, or you can reach us via the web at www.missiontoisrael.org. And now, here is Ted Weiland.
All right, this will be part 30 of Romans Vital Clues to Understanding Paul and the Remainder of the New Testament. Several times already throughout this series, I've alluded to the fact that Romans 11's discussion of the two living branches, the cultivated and the wild olive branches, is fulfillment of Ezekiel's two-stick prophecy found in the second half of Ezekiel 37. And I think what baffles me the absolute most is why so few people have connected Ezekiel 37, the last half of Ezekiel 37, to Romans chapter 11. Now, admittedly, I went a long time without ever seeing it myself, but once you see the prophecies, that prophecy and the other some of the others, and only we're going to look at several prophecies from different prophets that all fit together, and once you see that, it is so evident. But then it all hinges on those two vital clues that we have dealt with throughout this entire series of recognizing and identifying correctly the players that Paul is dealing with in and throughout the book of Romans. Anyway, I've alluded to that fact. Well, we're finally about to embark on our examination of the two olive branches. But rather than starting with Romans 11's two-branch fulfillment, let's begin by reading Ezekiel's two-stick prophecy. Don't miss that. Two-branch fulfillment, two-stick prophecy. Ezekiel chapter 37. Let's go through this first, and we'll, Lord willing, yet get to Romans 11 and Paul's discussion of the olive branches. Ezekiel 37, we're going to begin with essentially the second half of Ezekiel 37, basically a repeat of the first prophecy. If you remember, the first prophecy of Ezekiel 37 is the resurrection of the dead valley of dead bones, representing the whole entire house, 12 tribes of Israel. That at some point there was going to be this enlivening, being brought to life again, the bones, the dead Israel of old, somehow brought back to life. Well, essentially what we find in the second half is a repeat of that, just told in a different fashion and maybe filled out a little bit more than what you find in the first prophecy. So we want to begin with Ezekiel chapter 37 and verse 15. Let's begin by reading verses 15 through 17. It says, "The word of Yahweh came again unto me, saying, Moreover, thou son of man, take thee one stick and write upon it for Judah and for the children of Israel, his companions. Then take another stick and write upon it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and for all the house of Israel, his companions, and join them one to another into one stick. And they shall become one in thine hand." No question who this prophecy concerns, the house of Judah and the house of Israel. Consequently, lest Yahweh and Ezekiel be liars, the prophecy cannot be fulfilled by anyone but the house of Judah and the house of Israel. Now, some Christians, recognizing that this is a fact, and we want to deal with this before we actually get any further into this text, But some Christians do recognize the fact that this is about the house of Israel and the house of Judah, and therefore it can only be fulfilled in the house of Israel and the house of Judah. And therefore, some Christians who do recognize this, therefore, in an attempt to stay true to the declared recipients of this prophecy, not knowing where else to go with it, announce that it was fulfilled when Ezra and Nehemiah and those with them returned from the Babylonian captivity. However, there are at least two problems with this interpretation. First, only Judahites from the house of Judah went into the Babylonian captivity, and only Judahites returned from the Babylonian captivity. Now, an argument might be made that there was a scattering of a few Israelites here and there, but certainly not enough to represent the entire house of Israel that had gone into the Assyrian captivity. So, to begin with, let's recognize, for those who may not know the history, is that it was the house of Judah, and really only a remnant thereof of them, that went into the Babylonian captivity, and it was only a very small remnant of that remnant who returned with Ezra and Nehemiah from the Babylonian captivity. Now, it's true that the books of Ezra and Nehemiah both cite Judahites and Israelites. However, those terms are not used in reference to two different groups of people, that is, descendants of both the house of Judah and the house of Israel, but to only, listen to me, but to only the Judahite Israelites. They were Judahites and they were Israelites both. Only the Judah, it only refers to the Judahite Israelites of the house of Judah, of the house of Judah. Judahites by tribe and house, and Israelites by nationality. And the internal evidence for this fact is provided in several ways in Ezra and Nehemiah. In fact, it's overwhelming, the evidence, the fact that those terms, Judahites and Israelites, is only referring to the house of Judah. The most cogent being what is found in Ezra chapter 10. And what I'd like you to do is keep your place in Ezekiel 37, if you so choose. But let's turn back to Ezra chapter 10, a few books previous to the book of Psalms. Excuse me. Just after 2 Chronicles, Ezra. And we want to go to Ezra chapter 10, and let's read, to begin with, verses 5 through 7. Ezra chapter 10, beginning with verse 5, it says this: "Then arose Ezra and made the chief priest, the Levites, and all Israel, to swear that they should do according to his word, and they swear. Then Ezra rose up from before the house of God and went into the chamber of Johanan, the son of Eliashib. And when he came thither, he did eat no bread nor drink water, for he mourned because of the transgression of them that had been carried away. And they made proclamation," verse 7, "and they made proclamation throughout Judah and Jerusalem unto all the children of the captivity, that they should gather themselves together unto Jerusalem." And there in verse 7 it says, in verse 5 it describes all Israel, and in verse 7 it describes them as all the children of the captivity, speaking of all of the children of the captivity who had returned with him to Jerusalem and the land of Judah, who, according to some, is supposed to consist of the house of Judah and the house of Israel. In particular, if you go back to verse 5, you can see, at least from that much that we've read thus far, that would seem to be indicative in that the fact it was, he's referring to all Israel. And all Israel would then be, at least in our thinking, be all 12 tribes. And so some believe that those who came back to Jerusalem and Judah with Ezra, all this children of the captivity, are supposed to refer to all 12 tribes of the house of Judah and the house of Israel. verses 7 and 8. Verse 7 again, and he made proclamation throughout Judah and Jerusalem unto all the children of the captivity that should gather, that they should gather themselves together unto Jerusalem. Verse 8, and that whosoever would not come within 3 days, according to the counsel of the princes and the elders, all his substance should be forfeited. All of his possessions would be confiscated. All of his substance would be forfeited, and himself separated from the congregation of those that had been carried away. Pretty hefty judgment for those who would not gather to Jerusalem in the 3-day period. The word goes out, the couriers go out, the word is spread to all the those of the captivity that you either gather in 3 days or you're going to lose all your possessions, you're going to be destitute, and on top of that, we're going to separate you from those who do. You're going to be separated from the congregation of Judah or Israel. Pretty hefty judgment for not gathering. Now, don't you think, with that being the case, that if, quote, all the children of the captivity, remember it's the Babylonian captivity, not the Assyrian captivity, and not the Babylonian and Assyrian captivity, but it's all that, don't you think that if all the children of the captivity represented all 12 tribes with that kind of judgment hanging over them, that all 12 tribes would have assembled in Jerusalem on the 3rd day. Well, of course they would have. I mean, there may have been a few who said, there ain't no way we're doing this, and we'll just take off and do our own thing. But otherwise, we should see that if all Israel here and all those of the captivity represented all 12 tribes, that of course we're going to expect that all 12 tribes would gather, so as not to have to pay the judgment that was put upon them. Verses 8 and 9. Verse 8 again. And that whosoever would not come within 3 days, according to the counsel of the princes and elders, all his substance should be forfeited, and himself separated from the congregation of those that had been carried away. Verse 9. Then, it's 3 days later, then all the men of Judah and Benjamin gathered themselves together unto Jerusalem within the 3 days. Ha! And who did the men of Judah and Benjamin represent? Well, only we know, well, we should know, perhaps not everyone knows, but it was only, they only represented, they were representation of the two-tribed house of Judah. Now, Levi went with Judah, so Levites were there too, but no longer really considered a tribe, only considered the priest of the house of Judah and Benjamin. So, even if, think about this, so here we've got this judgment, only Judah and only Benjamin show up. And so, with the judgment in mind, even if all Israel represented both the house of Judah and the house of Israel, from this point on, it would no longer represent them, because by the judgment, if they were there, which they were not, but if they were there, by the judgment, they would have been separated from that point on, because only Judah and Benjamin showed up. Was it only Judah and Benjamin? Because that's who went into the Babylonian captivity, and that's who returned to the Babylonian captivity. So either way you cut it, there's no way that we find that we can adamantly declare that there was no two-stick or two-branch reunion at the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. They weren't there to begin with, but even if they were separated from this. They were dispersed from this point on. Fact is, the house of Israel was absent, and it takes both parties to fulfill Ezekiel's two-stick prophecy. But there's something else that also makes this oft-heard interpretation impossible. The timing of Ezekiel's two-stick prophecy is not old, but new covenant. Ezekiel 37, back to the prophecy itself. Ezekiel 37, and we're going to get to this a little bit later as we read through this a little bit further, but jumping down so that we can get the timing here. Ezekiel 37, and look at verse 22 to begin with, where it says, "And I will make them one nation," the two sticks representing the house of Judah and the house of Israel. They're going to become one in his hand. All of that represents that at some point in the future from the time of Ezekiel, that the house of Israel and the house of Judah would be reunited into one nation. "And I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel. And one king shall be king unto them all, and they shall be no more two nations, neither shall they be divided into two kingdoms any more at all." All right, and it begins by saying, "And one king shall be king unto them all," the house of Israel and the house of Judah reunited. And who, I ask you, would that king be? Verse 24, "And David, my servant, shall be king over them. And they shall have one shepherd. They shall also walk in my judgments and observe my statutes and do them." David. David had been dead and in the grave already for some 350 years, if my calculations are correct, by the time that Ezekiel prophesied preached this prophecy. At least 350 years he had already been in the grave, and even by the time we get to the New Covenant, we know that they're still claiming he ain't coming out, not anytime soon anyway, that he was a corpse in the grave. Well, of course, what we realize here is that it's not referring to the first, but to the second or greater David, Yeshua. Meaning, what we find here, and there's other evidence for the same, but that what we find here, it's a new covenant prophecy. Consequently, there is no way that Ezekiel's two-stick prophecy was fulfilled at the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. Now, for those who understand Ezekiel's is a new covenant prophecy, now that really creates a problem. That is, at least for those who believe the Jews in the Bible represent all 12 tribes of Israel. And therefore, they also don't have two separate groups of Israelites with which to unite, even under the new covenant, as is required by Ezekiel's prophecy. They've got them all, the Jews representing all 12 tribes. So they only have the one group of Israelites under the new covenant at any point in time to deal with. So they've created, even those who recognize this as a new covenant prophecy, if you do not have that one vital clue figured out correctly, that the Jews or Judahites only represent the house of Judah, you still don't have two parties by which to fulfill the covenant. Consequently, they're up a proverbial creek. Regardless when under, because some would maybe try to fulfill it. I don't know of any, but some of them would maybe have tried to fulfill it in the first century AD. I think most of them still think it's yet to happen. But regardless when, under the new covenant dispensation, they attempt to fulfill Ezekiel's prophecy with only one group of Israelites, they're still up the proverbial creek. Not so for those of us who understand that the Judahites represent only the two-tribed house of Judah and the ethne, the ten-tribed house of Israel. Suddenly, with that understanding, the biblical understanding and identification of those two groups of people, the Jews or Judahites and the ethne, regrettably translated Gentiles, we've got two groups of Israelites with which to work with. With these two vital clues, the door is open for us to proceed in now locating the fulfillment of Ezekiel's prophecies. So, well, we're not done with Ezekiel yet. I was going to jump over to Romans, but we're not there. Okay, let's continue, because there's some more here we want to glean from Ezekiel 37. Verses 15 and 16 again. It says, the word of Yahweh came again unto me, saying, moreover, thou son of man, take thee one stick and write upon it for Judah and for the children of Israel, his companions. Then take another stick and write upon it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and for all the house of Israel, his companions. First, it's dealing here with sticks. Well, what's a stick but a dead branch? It's a branch that's died. All right, with that in mind, verse 17, and join them one to another into one stick, that they shall become one in thy hand. Now, to become one, to take two sticks and for them to become one, grafted to each other, those sticks must become alive again. What, under the new covenant, we would probably describe as born again, if you will. And what would you call two dead sticks that have been born again or brought back to life? Well, now they had been branches that had died and become sticks, but the sticks have now come to life again, and therefore the two sticks would be branches. Living branches. Living sticks are branches. Thus, this is a prophecy not so much about two dead sticks as it is about two living branches. Hello? Romans chapter 11. Verses 17 and 19 of Ezekiel 37. Verse 17, and join them one to another unto one stick, and they shall become one in thy hand. And when the children of thy people shall speak unto thee, saying, wilt thou not show us what thou meanest by these? Say unto them, thus saith the Lord Yahweh, behold, I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel his fellows, and will put them with him, even with the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, and they shall be one in thine hand. Ezekiel's prophecy, now we can see, if we hadn't already, Ezekiel's prophecy is not so much about two living branches as it is about a new covenant reunion of the house of Judah and the house of Israel. If you recall, as we read in a previous message, it's the same prophecy that we read about, that we read and that we find in the book of Hosea. Hosea chapter 1, verses 8 through 11. Not, maybe wouldn't have connected these otherwise, but listen very carefully to how Hosea puts it. Hosea chapter 1, verses 8 through 11. He says, now when she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and bare a son. Then said God, name his name Lo-Ami, for ye are not my people. You know, we've discussed that term often, because this comes to play earlier in Romans. For you are not my people, and I will not be your God, speaking to the house of Israel, speaking of her divorce. Yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea. They won't go out of existence, in other words, which cannot be measured or numbered. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said to them, ye are not my people, there it shall be said unto them, ye are the sons of the living God. As quoted and used, employed by Paul in Romans 9, 23 through 27. And then in verse 11, this is the part that is identical to what we find in Ezekiel 37's prophecy. And then it says, then, when Israel is brought back, made sons of God, which can only happen under the new covenant through Christ and his redeeming blood sacrifice. Verse 11 then says, then shall the children of Judah, up to this point, and what I read, it's only been dealing with the house of Israel. House of Israel was divorced. They were the ones who at that time became not his people and who would again become his people at a later time. And then it says, then, at that time, then shall the children of Judah and the children of Israel be gathered together and appoint themselves one head. Ezekiel said one king. And they shall come up out of the land. The same prophecy that's found about the same two sticks, or two branches, that is, the very same two houses, as found in Ezekiel 37 and several other Old Testament prophecies. But wait a minute. The house of Israel had been divorced and dispersed throughout the world. Indeed, look at verse 21 of Ezekiel 37. Ezekiel 37, verse 21, "And say unto them, Thus saith the Lord Yahweh, Behold, I will take the children of Israel from among the heathen, whither they be gone, and I will gather them out of every side, and bring them into their own land." Now, the word heathen there is regrettably translated heathen, just like ethne is regrettably translated Gentiles. The word heathen is translated from the Hebrew word goyim, the Hebrew equivalent of the Greek ethne, and which, like ethne, simply means nations. And so what they're talking about is a born-from-above remnant from the house of Israel was to be gathered from among the non-Israelite nations throughout the world where they had been scattered or dispersed, to be joined with a born-again remnant from the house of Judah back in the land originally given to the 12 tribes, and where originally this reunion took place. Not in 1948, with a resettlement, or a settlement, it really wasn't even a resettlement, but a settlement of people who by their own admission are neither Israelites nor even Judahites. Reference the first sentence of the first chapter entitled Identity Crisis of the 1980 Jewish Almanac and all of their encyclopedias and many of their historians and anthropologists who admit they are not known as Jews today because of descent from Jacob Israel, but instead because they adopted the religion of Judaism. And so we're not talking 1948 here. Wrong people. You still don't have, not only do you not have two groups, you don't have even one group because you've misidentified people who are not Israelites as being Judites when in fact they're not. Instead, no, it's a reunion in the first century A.D. as described by Paul in Romans chapter 11, etc., hopefully as we will see. All right, still in Ezekiel 37, verses 21 and 22, it says, "And I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel, and one king shall be king to them all, and they shall be no more two nations, neither shall they be divided into two kingdoms any more at all." Let's see here. I guess that's as much as I wanted. Verse 22 begins, "And I will make them one nation." Remember in the last message we discussed Matthew 21 and verse 43, where Christ declared that the kingdom would be removed from the house of Judah and given to a nation bringing forth the fruits thereof. A nation here described as made up of two dead sticks that were to become two living branches, two houses of a remnant thereof who were to be quickened and reunited and thereby made one nation again. A nation described in 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 1 through 3, with 1 Peter 2, 9 and 10, something we discussed in an earlier message, as consisting, at least in part, of a born-again remnant of the house of Israel. That's whom Peter was dealing with to be reunited with the house of Judah. All right, verses 22 through 24. It says, "And I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel, and one king shall be king to them all, and they shall be no more two nations. Neither shall they be divided into two kingdoms any more at all. Neither shall they defile themselves any more with their idols, nor with their detestable things, nor with any of their transgressions. But I will save them out of their dwelling places where they have sinned, and will cleanse them, so they shall be my people, and I will be their God. And David, my servant, shall be king over them, and they shall have one shepherd. They shall also walk in my judgments and observe my statutes and do them." Now, does anything in verses 23 and 24 that I just read remind you of another corroborating prophecy regarding the new covenant? Note particularly the statements. It says, "So they shall be my people, and I will be their God. And they shall also walk in my judgments and observe my statutes and do them." Does that remind us of another New Covenant prophecy about the same groups of people? Well, I think we're done there with Ezekiel 37, but you might want to hold your spot if you want to. Turn to Jeremiah chapter 31. With those two statements in particular in mind. And I know some of you are very familiar with parts of Jeremiah 31, but there's so much more than the verses that we have so often looked at that we will get to before then. So let's start with verse 1. Jeremiah 31 and verse 1, and it says, At the same time, thus saith Yahweh, will I be the God of all the families of Israel, and they shall be my people. Who's Yahweh referring to here when he says all the families of Israel? Well, let's find out, because it's not necessarily a given until we use the context to determine. As we saw in the previous chapter, in Ezra chapter 10, all Israel only referred to the house of Judah. Is that the case here? Well, we will find out by the context. Okay, so who's Yahweh referring to with all the families of Israel? Look at verses 2 through 7 to begin with. It says, thus saith Yahweh, the people which were left of the sword found grace in the wilderness, even Israel, when I went to cause him to rest. Yahweh has appeared of old unto me, saying, yea, I have loved thee with an everlasting love. Therefore with loving kindness have I drawn thee. Again, I will build thee, and thou shalt be built, O Virgin of Israel. Should remind you of 2 Corinthians 11:2. Those who had defiled themselves were by Christ able to become virgins again. Again, I will build thee, and thou shalt be built, O Virgin of Israel. Thou shalt again be adorned with thy tabarets, and shall go forth in dances of them that make merry. Thou shalt yet plant vines upon the mountains of Samaria. The planters shall plant and shall eat them as common things, for there shall be a day that the watchman upon Mount Ephraim shall cry, arise ye and let us go up to Zion. Zion, another word for Jerusalem, unto Yahweh our God. For thus saith Yahweh, sing with gladness for Jacob, and shout among the chief of the nations, publish ye, praise ye, and say unto Yahweh, save thy people, the remnant of Israel. What kind of remnant? Jump down to verse 11. For Yahweh has redeemed Jacob and ransomed him from the hand of him that was stronger than he. So, we're talking about a redeemed and ransomed. Those terms should take us to the New Covenant. And the one who does redeem and the only one who can ransom. So we're talking about a redeemed and ransomed remnant. Listen to me. We're talking about a redeemed and ransomed remnant from all the families of Israel. That is, from both the house of Judah and the house of Israel. Hello? Are we possibly beginning to see how only a remnant and yet all Israel can be saved, as declared by Paul in Romans chapters 9 and 11. It's right here in Jeremiah 31, a remnant from all the families of Israel. When does Jeremiah declare this is to happen, that the remnant from all the families of Israel is to be redeemed and ransomed? Now we get to those familiar verses, verses 31 through part of 33. Behold, he says, this is all the same prophecy, behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant, by the way, keep in mind, we're looking for those phrases now from Ezekiel 37 that I said to focus in particularly. Have you ever considered them in light of another New Testament covenant prophecy? Not according to the covenant, he says in verse 32, that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, by which covenant they break, although I was a husband unto them, saith Yahweh. But, verse 33, but this shall be the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith Yahweh. I will put my law in their inward parts and write them in their hearts. He says, my law I will put in their hearts and their minds. That is, his statutes and his judgments, that he might do them. Ezekiel 37 and verse 24. Continuing, 31, I'm going to read it all again. Verse 31. It says, behold, again, days come, saith Yahweh, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Not only does Jeremiah identify this as a new covenant prophecy, telling us the when of this prophecy, but do not overlook with whom he declares the new covenant was to be engaged. And I use the word engaged intentionally in both senses of the word, as in made with, and its marital sense as well. Being that the new covenant, like the old covenant, was a marriage covenant between Yahweh and Israel, with she who rules with El or Elohim. All right, verses 31 through 33 again. Behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers. What fathers? Spiritual fathers? No. Physical fathers. In the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they break, although I was a husband unto them, saith Yahweh. But this shall be the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith Yahweh. I will put my law in their inward parts and write it in their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. I will be their God, it says, and they shall be my people. The exact same phrase as found in Ezekiel 37 and 27. How grand is this? I hope you're seeing how all of these prophecies, Hosea's and Jeremiah's and Ezekiel's, are all the same prophecies regarding the same things, and they only support each other in the conclusions that I'm sharing with you. How grand is this? Are you seeing how all of this fits so perfectly together? And there's more, because we have yet to get to Paul's discussion of the two living olive branches that precipitates everything that we've looked to already at this point. So, we've seen the prophecy, or prophecies, Hosea's, Jeremiah's, and Ezekiel's, that all fit together. Let's go to the fulfillment. Romans chapter 11. And beginning with verse 16, which is where we left off with in the last message. Romans chapter 11, verse 16, it says, for if the first fruit be holy, the lump is also holy. And if the root be holy, so are the branches. Now let's first discuss the root here. For without the root, there can be no branches, and there can be no fruit. Let's never forget John 15, whether we're looking at it in a more collective sense, as we find here in Romans chapter 11, or whether we're looking at it individually, and most importantly, when we look at it individually. Romans 15, verses 1 and 4 and 5. Where Christ says, I am the true vine. He could have said root. Same idea. I am the true vine, and my Father is the husbandman or vine dresser, depending on your version. And then in verse 4, he says, abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself, except it abide in the vine. And no more can ye, except you abide in me. Not only come to him, not only get into him, as we've talked about, into Christ, but we must therefore abide. Once we're in Christ, he says you must abide in Christ. Except it abide in the vine, no more can ye, except ye abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. He that abideth in me and I in him, the same bringeth forth fruit. For without me, you can do nothing. There cannot be a nation that bringeth forth the fruit thereof without the root. Jesus, Yeshua, is identified as the root of Jesse. And without him, there can be no reunion or restored relationship with Yahweh for any Israelite of any house. It takes the root. Isaiah 11, 10 through 12 in part says, "And in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, which shall stand for an ensign of the people." Not just any people, but the people. "To it shall the Gentiles," regrettably translated Gentiles here, it's the Hebrew word goyim, meaning nations, and should have been translated nations, "to it shall the nations seek. And it shall come to pass in the day that the Lord," and in this case it should be the Lord, not Yahweh, "they shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people. And he shall set up an ensign for the nations," goyim again, there it's translated correctly, "and shall assemble the outcast of Israel." What nations? The outcast of Israel. "And gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth." And so here in Isaiah 11, we have the same prophecy as in Ezekiel 37, Jeremiah 31, and Hosea 1. Isaiah 53, 2 and 8 in part says, "For he," speaking of Christ, "shall grow up before him," Yahweh, "as a tender plant and a root out of dry ground. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. All we," speaking of Israelites, "like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and Yahweh has laid on him the iniquity of us all. For the transgression of my people was he stricken." Additionally, the prophets of Isaiah and Jeremiah identified Yeshua as a branch, not just a root, but a branch through whom Israelites from both the house of Israel and the house of Judah would be saved. Isaiah 4 and verse 2, it says, "In that day shall the branch of Yahweh be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and comely for them that are escaped," a remnant, "for them that are escaped of the whole world." No one. Speaking of Israel, that was the intent of those that are escaped of Israel. Jeremiah 23, 5 and 6, "Behold, days come, saith Yahweh, that I will raise unto David," Ezekiel's King David, "that I will raise unto David a righteous branch, and a king shall reign and prosper, and shall execute judgment and justice in the earth. In his days Judah shall be saved, and Israel shall dwell safely. And this is the name whereby he shall be called, Yahweh our righteousness." Now the root, the vine, the principal branch, I think everyone recognizes as Christ. And only by being first grafted into him can the other branches be grafted into each other. Why? Because you can't take two dead sticks and graft them together. You can only take two living branches, and only the vine, the root, the principal branch could turn two dead sticks into living branches that could also then be grafted into each other. All right, Romans chapter 11, verse 16. "For the first root be holy, the lump is also holy. And if the root be holy, so are the branches." So now we've gone from the root, we're talking about the branches. What kind of branches? Verse 17. Verse 17, "And if some of the branches be broken off, and thou being a wild olive tree, and if some of the branches," speaking of the house, speaking of the Judahites, "be broken off, and thou being a wild olive tree, were grafted in among them," the Judahites, "and with them," the Judahites, "partaketh of the root and the fatness of the olive tree." Well, why olive branches? God just throw in olive branches in there? Why olive branches? Why not cypress or cedar branches? Remember, every word of Yahweh is perfect. In fact, in Psalms 12:6, it says it's been purified seven times. Not that the first time it was needed purifying, but just to exemplify that it's so perfect, it's like it was purified seven different times, like taking silver and purifying seven different times. God is expressing his word is absolutely perfect. Therefore, there has to be a reason he chose to inspire olive branches and not some other species. Olive branches must be indicative of something or someone? Well, like sheep, and certain other terms, some of which we've already discussed, olive trees in the Bible, when referring to people or nations, are Israelite specific. In other words, only are Israelites ever identified as olive trees or olive branches in the Bible. For example, among others, let's look at Jeremiah 11 and Hosea 14. Jeremiah 11, verses 1 and 2 and 16 says, "The word that came to Jeremiah from Yahweh, saying, Hear ye the words of the covenant, and speak unto the men of Judah," we're talking about the house of Judah now, "and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem." Verse 16, "Yahweh call by name a green olive tree, fair and goodly fruit." They were the cultivated, the good fruit of the olive tree. And then regarding the house of Israel, it says in Hosea 14, 1, 5, and 6, it says, "O Israel, return unto Yahweh thy God." So they're separated, but he's calling them back. He says, "O Israel, return unto Yahweh thy God, for thou hast fallen by thine iniquity." And then in verse 4 he says, "And I, if you do this, I will be as the dew unto Israel," the dew that grows the trees and the vegetation and the branches. "I will be as the dew unto Israel. He shall grow as the lily and cast forth his fruits as Lebanon." His branches, talking about the house of Israel, who's now divorced and dispersed throughout the world. "Thou, if he comes back," he says, "and his beauty shall be at," "his branches shall spread, and his beauty shall be as the olive tree, and his smell as Lebanon." In Hosea 9, 16 and 17, Hosea informs us that after Yahweh divorced the house of Israel, their root was dried up. They were cut off from the root, and they were cast away. However, not to be overlooked, this casting away in diaspora, now think about this, this casting away in diaspora did not change them from an olive to a cypress or some other kind of tree. They were still olive branches or olive trees. No, instead, they wouldn't have become another kind of tree. Instead, they simply became a wild olive tree. That is the wild olive tree of Romans chapter 11 and verse 17. Isaiah prophesied that the house of Israel would have its branch cut off. It was to be cut off. Isaiah 9, 9 through 14 in part says, "Ephraim and the inhabitants of Samaria," the house of Israel, "turneth not unto him that smiteth them, neither do they seek Yahweh of hosts. Therefore Yahweh will cut off from Israel head and tail, branch and rush in one day." When he divorced them and cast them away, dispersed them, took them into captivity by the Assyrians. In Romans 11:17, Paul used the term wild olive tree, speaking of whoever it was there. Well, I think we're starting to figure out who it was, aren't we? Yahweh used similar language to describe the house of Israel after she had turned away from him. In Jeremiah chapter 2 and verse 21, he said, "Yet I had planted thee," speaking of the house of Israel, "I had planted thee a noble vine, holy, a right seed. How then art thou turned into the degenerate plant of a strange vine unto me?" Or he could have said branch. Why strange? Because Yahweh had divorced her and she had gone wild. Think about that term. And she'd gone wild. Much the same as we might describe an adulterous wife as having gone wild. She had gone wild. She had been divorced. She'd committed adultery and he divorced her, and it only got worse after he divorced her. She went wild. The Old Testament prophets never describe non-Israelites as a wild plant of any kind. However, that's exactly how the prophet Isaiah described the house of Israel when in rebellion to her husband. Isaiah 5, 2 and 7. Notice how many of these prophecies all collaborate what we're saying. Isaiah 5, 2 and 7, again in part, it says, My well-beloved hath a vineyard," note vineyard, because we want to find out who the vineyard is, in a very fruitful hill. And he looked that it should bring forth grapes, as any vine dresser or owner would. And he looked to that it should bring forth grapes, and it brought forth wild grapes. And I will, then he, later he says, and I will lay it waste, it shall not be pruned nor digged, but there shall come up briars and thorns. It was to go wild after he had, he says, I will lay it waste, I'll divorce. It was divorce language. It shall not be pruned nor digged, but there shall come up briars and thorns. That's what happens when there's no vine dresser, and it goes wild. But then he identifies the vineyard, for the vineyard of Yahweh of hosts is the house of Israel. She's the one who was divorced at that time and went wild. Now watch this. Then it says, and the men of Judah, the house of Judah, his pleasant plant. End of quote. The difference between a pleasant plant and a vineyard that's gone wild. Isaiah identified the wild grapes with the house of Israel and Judah as the pleasant plant. Furthermore, verses 5 through 6 describe the house of Israel. Talking about Romans 11, I think that should be verses 15 and 16. Describe the house of Israel as an uncultivated vineyard, whereas the house of Judah is depicted as Yahweh's pleasant plant or good plant. And as we will see, these descriptions, and that was Isaiah 5, 6, and 7, and as we will see, these descriptions are nearly identical to Paul's portrayal of the ethne, the nations, and the Judahites in Romans 11, 24, respectively, which we will get to, Lord willing, in the next message. Not only that, but Hosea prophesied that the house of Israel would be reunited with Yahweh, their root, and that they would again become a fruit-bearing, not cypress tree, not cedar tree, not any other species, but when they would be reunited with Yahweh, Yeshua, their root, that they would become a fruit-bearing olive tree. Hosea 14, 1 through 6 in part. O Israel, return unto Yahweh thy God, for thou hast fallen by thine iniquity, and subsequently went wild. I will heal their backsliding. I will love them freely, for mine anger is turned away from him. I will be as the dew unto Israel. He shall grow as the lily, and cast forth his roots as Lebanon. His branches shall spread, and his beauty shall be as the olive tree. With Ezekiel's two-stick prophecy and all of these other prophecies now in play, it is absolutely inescapable that Romans 11's cultivated and wild olive branches represent not Israelites and non-Israelites, as it is so often interpreted, regrettably, but instead the house of Judah and the house of Israel, respectively. That is, a born-again remnant from all the families of Israel. Hopefully, this whets your appetite for the remainder of Paul's two-branch discussion in Romans 11, which we've only just begun. But hopefully you can see by the prophets who these nations and who these Jews or Judahites represent, and begin to see what a beautiful, beautiful fulfillment of God's prophecies fulfilled right here in his word already, giving us all the more reason to trust our God, that he is a God of his word and that he carries it out to the T, and that we don't have any business changing any part of the prophecies. If we don't understand how a prophecy is fulfilled, that we find fulfilled in the New Testament, that's our problem. We need to trust our God and say, hey, I'm laying this thing aside until I figure out how God fulfills this. It's always been right there, maybe somewhat hidden for whatever reason God chose to hide it, but it's there. When you take the prophecies for what they say, and you take the definitions for who they are in the New Testament, And you see that the two fit hand in glove, hand in hand, perfectly in all respects of the prophecies. Praise God. Let's stand. We'll close in prayer. Heavenly Father, Lord, once again, we thank you and praise you, Father, for, first of all, for who you are, and Father, for what you've done for us and to us, Lord, regardless whether we understand it or not, but how much more beautiful it is when you allow us to piece together the puzzles and put together your word in such a beautiful way to see the harmony between the prophets of the old and the fulfillment of the new, and particularly, at least for me, I know, to see this prophecy, the two-stick prophecy of Ezekiel, fulfilled so beautifully in the two-branch fulfillment that Paul provides us in Romans chapter 11. Father, thank you for your faithfulness, regardless of our own or our lack of understanding. Help this to open the doors, Father, the hearts and minds of others who, Father, can partake in the beauty of these passages and how and their harmony as they fit so perfectly together. Bless us, guide us, open our hearts and minds to this and to whatever else, Lord, it is that you choose to reveal of yourself in your word. We praise you and thank you for these things in Yeshua the Christ. Amen.